attach the mic.
It's nice to be back. It was a blessing to get to go to Bay City, Michigan last week. Just the story how that happened. I've been praying for my son and daughter-in-law there. They both profess Christ as children, but they don't have interest in attending church at this point. I really wanted to go back and talk to them. I've been praying for a chance to do that. Then a week ago, out of the blue, got an email from one of the inspection companies I work for saying, is there anyone out there in the U.S. that could go to Bay City, Michigan to catch up on about 60 inspections there? So I said, Lord, is that me? So I prayed about it and then let them know I'd be interested. And they said, oh, yes, and we'll even pay you extra to go there. So I got paid to go see my son and daughter-in-law for 3 days on a business trip. And that was a blessing. And everything worked out. I mean, all my other work in the area here was really slack that week. And the weather back there was just right for taking pictures of houses for those 3 days. So it was just seemed to be of the Lord. And so I didn't really want to leave you, but this was seemed to be of the Lord to go there and do that. So we got a question here. Which book in the Bible is one of the two that never mention God? And is one of the only two with a woman as the title character. And you'll know the answer if you've got the handout in your hands. Esther. Book of Esther. Never mentions God. Doesn't even mention prayer or faith or religion at all. Yet it's in the Bible. And has a woman, of course, as the title character. So we're going to review the story in a minute. But just a little background, and this is on your handout. So you could take this home and review it. But the book of Esther is about Jews living outside of the land of the Jews, outside the land of Israel. Jews living in the capital of the Persian Empire, a place called Shushan, or sometimes Susa, if you want to say S instead of SH. They seem like very secular in nature because the book never mentions God or prayer. But they are there, and this seems to be during the reign of the Persian emperor Xerxes, called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. Now, why is he called Ahasuerus? Well, Xerxes was the name the Greeks gave him. His actual name in the Persian language was closer to the Ahasuerus, which was the Jewish way of saying his name. So he's called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. And he's best known in secular history for his attempt to subjugate the Greeks. In 480 BC, he with a huge, huge army, 360,000 soldiers and elephants, you know, equivalent tanks and whatever else, across the Hellespont on a pontoon bridge that his engineers built and made it into Greece and ravaged much of it. But he was halted for a while at the Battle of Thermopylae, but he had a huge fleet, a gigantic fleet of Persian ships. But they were defeated by the doughty Greeks in the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. And inferior armada of Greeks, but they had smaller ships, more maneuverable, and they tricked the Persian fleet with their great big giant ships full of soldiers into a narrow area where they couldn't maneuver. And the Greeks fought ferociously, and they wiped out much of Xerxes' navy. In the Great Battle of Salamis, one of the historical great battles of history, history-changing battles. If they had not defeated the Persians there, we wouldn't have had Western civilization today as we have it, because the Persians were defeated, the Greek civilization flourished, and gave us a geometry and the Greek plays and the Greek language and later on the foundation for the empire of Alexander the Great, who spread Greek learning and culture all over the world. So, well, that's background. Anyway, about these Jews who are in the book of Esther. The Jews in Babylon, a bunch of them, went back under Zerubbabel to when Cyrus, the first Persian emperor, made a decree that they could return to their homeland and go back to Jerusalem. A large number of them went back under the leadership of Zerubbabel, and after some years there, they managed to rebuild the ruined temple and reinstitute the worship of the Lord there in Jerusalem. And about a century after that, we saw in the previous months here in this class how Ezra and then 13 years later Nehemiah traveled to Judea and really helped those people there. And under Nehemiah, they rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem and set up the gates again so that it was a safe place where the Jews could move and be protected from enemies. And that's when the government and the population of Judah really began to grow again after Nehemiah. But many Jews did not go back. They had good jobs, commercial enterprises going on in the Persian Empire, and they became urban Jews, just like most Jewish people today, thousands of years later. And they pursued crafts and businesses and jewelry stores and banking and whatever else they could do in these urban centers. So that's the Jews that we find here in the book of Esther. We find in the book of Acts that there were Jews living in all the major cities of the Roman Empire wherever the Apostle Paul traveled. If he went to a big city like Antioch or wherever, he always found a congregation of Jews there, Corinth or Philippi, wherever it was. He found Jews, and that's where his ministry would begin. And during these days of the Roman Empire, the Jews were well respected because of their superior morality to the Romans and pagans around them. And this attracted a lot of Gentiles who gave up the pagan gods and wanted to be like the Jews. And so we find all these references to God-fearers, to Greeks, and so on in the Jewish synagogues where the Apostle Paul would minister. So going on, though, talking about the Jews, well, let's just go on the story here. We're going to review the story of Esther next and try to do it this way. Well, no, let's back up again. In your handout, I've addressed the fact of why isn't God mentioned in the book of Esther. So I thought maybe we'd address that first. Why? We don't know. I don't know for sure, but I can give you some possibilities. Number one, there might have been superstition. Ever since the Babylonian captivity, we find the Jews stop. And historically, we find they stop speaking the covenant name, the Hebrew name of God, which we know as Yahweh, spelled YHWH. And there was just some sort of a superstitious fear of actually saying that. When they wrote the name YHWH in their copies of the Hebrew Bible, they would give it the vowel pointings for the word Adonai, which means Lord. So instead of Yahweh, it looked like Yehovah, which became the English word Jehovah. But they put the vowel pointings in because every time they read their scriptures aloud, when they came to the YHWH, they would say, Lord, Adonai. So maybe out of superstition, there's no mention of God in the book of Esther. That might have been part of it. Another possibility, number two, is fear of persecution. The Jews did not assimilate into the surrounding cultures, just like many Jews today do not. Well, they look just like the rest of us, and you never know it's a Jew that's treating you in the doctor's office, or operating on you in the operating room or whatever, or helping you with a legal matter or whatever. But many, many professional people are actually Jews that look just like everybody else. But they don't totally assimilate because they still are circumcised, have their bar mitzvahs. Some of them are faithful attenders in the synagogue and observe the Sabbath and Jewish holy days like Yom Kippur. They still consider themselves Jews, even though they're, you know, patriotic Americans and just like the rest of us. So maybe this was the case here in the time of Esther in the capital of the Persian Empire. I wrote here, Jews have historically in many places learned to lie low and to attract as little attention as possible. And of course, in the New Testament, we find that that was a little bit different because of the respect they had in the Roman Empire among the pagans. They were kind of proudly showing off their Judaism and attracting many, many Gentile converts during the days of the Apostle Paul. But it's possible that when the book of Esther was written, the writer, who is anonymous, was trying to protect fellow Jews by not making overt references to their beliefs because they would not go along with the paganism. They would not honor the many pagan gods in the world of their day in which they live. And a third possibility was just trying to avoid sensationalism. Near the end of the story, we're told that many of the people of the land became Jews. There was no preaching or other evangelistic activity occurring, but many pagans, after they saw the lives and the work of God for the Jews, they wanted to become Jews too. But there was no evangelizing, and it was contrary to the Jewish mind to evangelize. In the Old Testament, like in the book of Deuteronomy and other places, God encouraged the Jews to welcome non-Jews, to be welcoming. God wanted other peoples to believe in Him beside the Jews, but He never commanded them to evangelize. Their culture was to be the display, the reality of God, and by hearing about them, the other nations were to seek out the true God in Jerusalem. Now, that's changed today. We are commanded to go into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature. Anyway, that's to get into the outline now. Chapter 1. I hope you have your Bible open. We're not going to read the whole book of Esther. There's too much there. But it starts out with this huge celebration in the capital city of Shushan. The date is approximately 483 B.C. We know from secular history that 483 B.C., Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, I'm going to call him, called in all the leaders of his realm to plan an invasion of Greece. They spent 3 years in preparing, but it started in 483. So apparently he kicked it off with this huge feast that's described in the Book of Esther. The Book of Esther gets into none of the politics of the day. Absolutely, it totally ignores it. But he made this huge feast, verse 3, third year of his reign, which would be about 483 B.C., and he showed off the power of Persia, Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. And the description there is there given the rest of the chapter to just impress us with how lavish and how luxurious and how beautiful and magnificent this great feast was. But he gets a little bit drunk. And verse 10 says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. Now, wine back in those days was not like our wines today. It wasn't fortified. You had to drink a lot of it to get buzzed. But after 7 days of drinking, he is getting a little bit tipsy. And he gets this the crazy idea of showing off his beautiful queen to all the people he wants to impress, these rulers of the provinces and so on. So he orders Queen Vashti to come out on display. Here's an artist's picture of Queen Vashti refusing. This is from the art gallery at Bob Jones University. You see on the right, you see her ladies-in-waiting are urging her, you know, do it, do it, do it. She doesn't want to. On the left-hand side, you see a chamberlain with his arms up in the air in frustration. She won't go. I won't go into conjecturing any more about that, but she refused to come and showed off as his trophy queen for the sake of her drunken husband. Well, she refuses. This, of course, causes a big problem. And so the king deposes her on the advice of his counselors. They say, you know, if the word gets out that she got away with disobeying her husband, direct command, then all the wives are going to disrespect us everywhere. So we got to make an example out of her. Yeah, good enough. So they do that. In chapter 2, it says, verse 1, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Oh, we need a new queen. So his counselors come up with an idea they know will appeal to this king. He's already has a harem, but they say, let's have a new beauty contest, and you pick one of these young gals to be your new queen. Being a Persian monarch, he liked that idea very much. And so then, verse 5 of chapter 2, we're introduced to Esther. In Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away. The who refers not to Mordecai, but to his great-grandfather Kish, because this is like 150 years later, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. I think that was like 598 B.C. or something like that. Anyway, a long time before Mordecai's life. But she'd been raised by this relative, verse 7, and he, Mordecai, brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, an orphan. And the maid was fair and beautiful. And Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So he's older relative and takes her into his home with his family to raise her as his own daughter. So that's the background about Esther. Well, she gets picked somehow. I don't think she tried out. I think somehow she was observed and seen and known and for her beauty, and they said, you come. And so she has to be part of this collection of women to be placed in the king's harem and possibly chosen as his queen. And chapter 2 goes on to tell all about us and how they did that. Verse 10 tells us, Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her, commanded her, that she should not show it. There was anti-Semitism back then. And so it was out of a caution, wisdom, don't reveal your ethnic background. Don't reveal that you're a Jew. Don't tell anybody. Again, this is a clue why there's no mention of God or so on in religion in the book of Esther. There was a undercurrent and incipient hostility toward Jews in this particular place, in the capital city of Shushan. Jews are different from everybody else. Everybody else, you know, pays lip service to everybody else's gods. Jews won't do that. They insist there's only one God, and he's the only one we will honor. So anyway, the story goes on to tell us how she gets chosen to be the queen. She is right away, she is given special treatment. Verse 9, this Haggai, keeper of the women, says, verse 9, the maiden pleased him. She obtained kindness of him. He speedily gave her things for purification with such things as belonged to her and seven maidens, her own servant girls, which were meet or suitable to be given to her out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. Now there's politics going on here. This guy in charge of the harem sees Esther, and it's not just her beauty, but there's something about her. Her grace, her dignity, her personality. He sees she's an obvious winner. And so for his own sake, he gives her special treatment because he sees she's going to be the winner here. She's going to be the queen. So that's why she gets a special treatment. And the king, you know, these girls are called in one by one to spend the night with the king. Horrible process, but he really likes her, and he decides to make her his queen. Now, after she becomes queen, we find out of that verse 19, and when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. So her foster father begins visiting the palace grounds to check on her. And verse 21 says, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those who kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. When inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So he saves the king's life by revealing a plot that he overhears. Just by chance, he happens to hear. And we're going to see lots of things happen just by chance in the book of Esther. So he gets word to Esther. He can't go in and visit her. No one's allowed, but he's able to send they're able to send messages back and forth to each other through the servants. And so, by the way, history tells us that this king, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, he did die by assassination about 20 years later. There was, no matter all the security, it was still dangerous to be a king in those days. Now, in chapter 3, we find that Mordecai incurs the hatred of Haman. Verse 1, after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Some think that's related to Agag that Samuel killed. I don't think so. The Amalekites were wiped out a long time ago. This guy was from a place called Agag, which was a city in the Persian Empire. That's why it's called the Agagite. Anyway, he promoted him, advanced him, set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Why? What not? Why not? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute if we have time. But just now the story, just to get through the story right now, Mordecai won't do it. He won't, you know, show him this extreme reverence that Haman's expecting. And everybody wants to know, why aren't you doing that? And so they call this to Haman's attention, verse 4. There's this guy over here that won't bow down like the king said we should. And he had told them, when they asked him, why aren't you bowing down, he told them, I'm a Jew. We don't give that kind of reverence to anybody except our God. Now, they would bow, of course. I mean, all through the Old Testament, you know, the books of the Kings and 1st, 2nd Samuel, everybody bows and show out of respect, you know, but it's a bow of respect, you know, like a nod or a salute or something like that. It's not a bow of worship. But that's what had been decreed concerning Haman, obviously, which is the only reason why Mordecai would refuse to bow to him. Well, Haman really takes this personally. And Haman is so upset, and he finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, he decides in his vanity, well, I'm just going to get all the Jews killed, not just this guy. I'm going to all killed. I hate Jews. Of course, maybe Satan is behind this, inspiring this. So he gets the king to issue orders to kill all the Jews in the entire kingdom. This minority who just don't conform, we'll get rid of all of them. It's to the king's interest. And he convinces the king that they should do this. These people are different from everybody else. They have their own laws. You know, they won't work on the Sabbath, and they won't eat pork, and they do this and they do that, and they mutilate their baby boys and all this stuff. You know, we got it. It's to your advantage for the harmony of the kingdom to get rid of these people. He convinces King Ahasuerus to get rid of these people, so they. Right, it's written out in decree, seal of the king's seal, and that's be done. But when to do it? Well, they have to pick a date. So Haman, being superstitious, goes to the magicians and they cast lots. And we don't know exactly how they did this lot, but the Persian word for lot is pur, from which the Hebrew got the word purim, plural, of pur. And somehow the soothsayers, they come up with this date about 11 months away, on the 13th day of the 12th month. That is the auspicious day when the gods will bless for killing all the Jews. So this is the date set, 11 months from now, and this is posted in the decree, and it's sent out across the Persian Empire that on the 13th day of the 12th month that everybody's to kill the Jews. And verse 13, letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, it's pretty inclusive, in one day, even on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. You know, you get to loot their houses after you kill them. This is a real nice incentive to make sure it gets done. Otherwise, why would you want to kill this nice neighbor of yours? But he's got some, he's a Jew. He's got some gold. He's got some nice artwork in his house, and we can take it. So they pick this date, and the proclamation puts the Jews in despair. Verse 15 says, the king of Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. There were lots of Jews living in Shushan. It's a capital city, and the Jews tended to gravitate to the major cities because they were no longer farmers and sheep herders like they were back in the land of Palestine. Now they are very urban and urbanized and follow those kind of work. So they tend to gravitate to the big cities. And there's a verse in 3 that says, there was great mourning among the Jews, chapter 4, verse 3. There was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So the proclamation puts the Jews in despair. What can we do? We're just a small minority group surrounded by all these Gentiles. Now, Esther's insulated from all of this. You know, there's not much news about the outside world in the harem. Well, there is news. I mean, news is always coming and going, talking, but she finds out that Mordecai is outside dressed in sackcloth. Something terrible has happened. That's when a Jew replaces clothing with sackcloth. I mean, something is really bad happening. He's mourning. What is he mourning? And so she sends a messenger out to find out from him. The messenger comes back with this explanation from Mordecai. Mordecai, verse 7, Mordecai told this messenger of all that had happened unto him and of the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Also, he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make request before him for her people. So he asked her to intercede with the king. Well, she's afraid, and she sends back a reply, verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, which is not called, not invited, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. The king hasn't even wanted to see her for the last 30 days. So So maybe she's not that much of a favorite with the king anymore. This is a worry. How does Mordecai reply? Well, he sends a reply back to her. Verse 13, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house, which includes him, of course, shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Key verse for the book of Esther. So she decides to try. Verse 16, she messages back to him, go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and got all the Jews to pray for her. So they're communicating, you see, by texting, but they don't have phones. It's all written on paper. But anyway, here's another artist, exception. This is Esther. She looks a little bit worried there. This is probably when she's getting ready to go in to see the king without being invited. I imagine that's what that picture is supposed to represent. So she fasts for 3 days. She puts on her on the third day. So maybe she's only fasted for 2 days, but she puts on her robes on the third day without any breakfast, and she walks into the throne room. Chapter 5, verse 1. Came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel, her best glorious clothing, stood in the inner court of the king's house, the inner court, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against, opposite the gate of the house. So he can see her standing there. And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Then said the king unto her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What's your request? It shall even given to thee to the half of the kingdom. And Esther said, if it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. So the king said, hey, cause Haman we and I are invited to a special banquet with the queen. He knows she's up to something, but he has to go to her little banquet to find out what it is. But this is fun. I mean, he likes this as a break from the boredom of being king. And so they do it. So at the banquet, we read in chapter 5 how the king asks her what she wants. What is it, Esther? What is thy petition? Verse 6. It shall be granted to thee. What is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. And her petition, verse 7. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow, as the king has said. Okay, if you really do, you come back tomorrow, and I'll let you know tomorrow what it is. So she's building the suspense here, and this is very deliberate on her part. And maybe she's afraid, but maybe she is being strategic here. She's building suspense. Come back tomorrow night, one more banquet, and then I'll tell you what I really want. She must want something really, really big, thinks the king. Well, Haman goes home after this banquet, and he is just full of himself. And he brags to his wife Zeresh and his family about how he was the only one invited to dine with the king and the queen. But when he left the king's palace, that awful Jew, Mordecai, would not bow down to him. Well, they have an idea. Look, honey, his wife says, just build a, you know, ask the king to have Mordecai hanged, and they'll take care of it, okay? And you won't have to worry about that anymore, sweetie. So that's what they do. Zeresh, his wife's friend, said, verse 14, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high. A standard cubit, 18 inches, would be like a 75-foot high gallows. And tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereof. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman. So he sends the carpenters out. And there's neighbors hear all this banging and whatever. But that night, apparently, there's this big, tall, 75-foot post with a pulley at the top all set up. What's that for? So he has this gallows built. But something happens. And the book of Esther is this book of amazing coincidences, which are not really coincidences because God's in control of everything. King can't sleep. So he thinks, I can't sleep. So he has them come in and just read the boring official records to him. If anything will make him drowsy, that will do it. So they start reading the records, and they read about how Mordecai revealed a plot to kill the king. And it was discovered and found to be true, and the perpetrators the plotters were executed. And the king says, well, what did we do to reward the guy? Well, Your Majesty, there's no record. Well, we ought to do something about that. So the next morning, Haman shows up bright and early in the king's court, and he's going to ask the king for permission to execute Mordecai. But before he can ask, the king says, come on in here, Haman. And says, Haman, what do you think the king should do to a man he really wants to honor? And Haman thinks, that's me. And so he concocts this big thing about the king having him paraded around the city on a horse, and with the herald shouting out, thus be it done to the man the king wants to honor. And this is what Haman wants. And the king says, that's a good idea. Okay, there's a guy up in the court named Mordecai. You take him and do for him what you just described for me. So Haman has no choice but to lead Mordecai around the city on the back of a horse and say, thus be it done to the man whom the king wants to honor. And then he goes home. Very, very hangdog expression, I'm sure. His wife and the others tell him that's what's happened to him is a bad omen. Well, the second banquet comes, chapter 8. And, chapter 7. We're in chapter 7 now. Here comes, and the king says, all right, sweetheart, what do you want me to do? What is it you want? And she says, verse 3, then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. If we had only been sold for slaves, bondmen, and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. The king Ahasuerus answered, said to Esther the queen, who is he? Where is he that durst presume in his heart to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. And then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen, and the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Here's another artist conception. Esther is pointing at Haman, this wicked Haman, telling her husband, the king, there in the middle. Verse 8, the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed, not really a bed, but rather a divan, a couch. They dined like the Greeks did, stretched out on couches for the meal. And he's begging Esther, but it doesn't look good. And then said the king, will he force the queen also? And he's accusing her of attempting rape before me in the house. As the word went out of the king's mouth, they, that is all the servants around, covered Haman's face. He's a condemned man now. So he's taken away, and one of the servants pipes up and says, by the way, did you know that this man Haman had built a gallows 75 feet high to kill, hang Mordecai? Servants know everything, but they keep their mouths shut until the right moment to speak up. So, oh, said the king, well, what poetic justice, you know, hang him on those gallows. And they do. Chapter 8 tells us how the king Mordecai how the king honors Mordecai. But the laws of when an edict has been issued in the Persian Empire, it cannot be changed. So what are we, the law has already been issued that all the Jews have to be killed. So this hasn't been resolved yet. So Esther comes back to the king again, and he holds out the scepter, and she begs for her people's lives. And what can be done? Well, the king has an idea. We can't undo the law, because you just don't undo the laws of the Medes and Persians. But we can issue a new edict that all the Jews on that date are supposed to fight their enemies. And they've got 11 months to prepare now, to arm themselves and organize, be ready to kill all the ones that want to kill them. That's what we'll do. So they sent out this new edict sent out through the empire. And so the day comes, the 13th day of the 12th month, and they all defend themselves. Mordecai gets to write out the proclamation. And on that date, they're supposed to defend themselves, fight for their lives. Well, they do pretty well. It goes on to describe, it says they stood on verse 16 of chapter 9, they killed 75,000. They killed 300 men in Shushan. And they also take care of Haman's 10 sons. Then afterward, Mordecai issues this proclamation to all the Jews to celebrate Purim, the plural of pur, lots, for all generations to come. Jews to this day still celebrate Purim. And he is commemorated in chapter 10 as a great Jew. So we're getting short on time, so we'll hurry along here. Just some other facts. The name Esther is probably a derivative of the Persian word stara, which means, any idea? Yes. Her Jewish name, which we found in chapter 2, verse 7, was Hadassah. Anybody know what that means? That's the Hebrew word for myrtle. Myrtle is a beautiful bush that grows all around that part of the world. It has fragrant, it's an evergreen, has fragrant leaves with medicinal qualities, a popular plant. And, just like today, people name their daughter Holly or Rose. Hadassah was a good name for a Jewish girl. Interesting, we already saw this. Mordecai was the great-grandson when the Jews deported to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. There's his lineage. We don't know the author. There's been some controversy about who Ahasuerus was. The vast majority of scholars believe he was Xerxes, because it dovetails with the dates of Xerxes' invasion of Greece and so on. All of these dates that are given, that this happened in the 7th year of his reign, this happened in the 12th year of his reign, and so on. It fits the secular history we know about Xerxes. But some ignorant people, because Esther doesn't say Xerxes, they say, oh, it's just a fairy tale. No, he wasn't called Xerxes by the people in that part of the empire. Xerxes was a Greek name of his name, actual name. I can't pronounce his actual name. But interestingly, they have found an inscription dating from the reign of Xerxes that names some guy named Mordecai as an official in Susa, the capital city. Why couldn't that be another way of spelling Mordecai, as the Jews spelled Mordecai? In any case, this book couldn't have been written later than 330 B.C., The main reason why Artaxerxes is sometimes given as Ahasuerus is simply because Josephus said it was Artaxerxes. But Josephus was writing 5 centuries later, and a lot of stuff in the book of Josephus is inaccurate. So I think we can ignore that and say it's really Xerxes, the father of Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes was the emperor during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, a generation later. So Bible critics question its authenticity because these events are not mentioned by the Greek historian Herodotus. It's by Herodotus that we know most of what we know about the Persian Empire. But the problem is, Herodotus is only interested in facts about the wars between his Greek people and the Persians. He was not interested in who the king was married to or anything like that. So that has nothing to do with questioning the authenticity of Esther. Here's what I think is the absolute proof. There's no other way to explain why Jewish people have been celebrating the Feast of Purim since long before Christ, except that something enormous happened. These facts actually occurred. That's why it became a celebration observed by Jews worldwide way centuries before Christ. It really, really happened. And as the book of Esther explains in the last two chapters, this is where the Feast of Purim began. They called it Pur after Lot's. Again, chance. The chance is the theme all the way through. One of the themes all the way through the book of Esther. As she was chosen as a candidate for queen, that was by chance. She was chosen to be the new queen. Mordecai, by chance, hears about a plot to assassinate the king. By chance, the 13th of Adar is chosen. The Bible says that the lot is cast, but the whole disposal of there is in the hands of the Lord. God is behind all of this. Why couldn't the king sleep the night before Mordecai was supposed to be hanged? Just chance, but God made him sleepless. He thought hearing the royal records read would make him sleepy, and just by chance, they read the part about Mordecai's good deed. And just by chance, Haman's on hand when the king wants to reward Mordecai, and just by chance, Haman thinks he's the one, and Haman's in a bad position when the king walks in from the garden, and the king says, that's it, kill him. And by chance, Chamberlain knows about Haman's plan to hang Mordecai and so on. Chance by chance by chance. Some questions? Why no mention of God? We've talked about that already. Their habitual modes of thought and speech on this part of the Persian Empire may have been secular, even though they maintained their Jewish culture with a sense of divinely guided destiny, just like the a Jewish person you know here in Sioux Falls may not talk about his Jewishness or parade it, but he may observe the Sabbath and Yom Kippur and so on. The superstitious fear of mentioning God, we've mentioned that. Worry about antagonizing. How about this question? Should Esther have resisted being taken into a pagan king's harem? Some people think she shouldn't have gone. Well, the answer is it was comply or die. And secondly, women were expected in that culture to marry anyone that they were assigned to. It was not a moral choice on their part who they married. No woman in the Bible was ever condemned for being some man's second wife, third wife, or fourth wife, or so on. You know, it was on the man for that, not on the woman. How about this? Shouldn't Mordecai have just bowed to Haman like everyone else did? Why did he refuse to bow? Obviously, it was because this type of bowing was a bow of worship, something no God-fearing Jew could do. And why did Esther request all the Jews in Shushan fast? Well, all through the Old Testament, we find people fasting to show sincerity in order to gain God's favor. Many, many examples. David, Ahab, and that was answered, by the way, even though he was not a good king. Ezra, his group fasted. Joel had Israelites fast because of the locust plague. God told Jeremiah they wouldn't fast. Well, we find fasting in the New Testament church. It was after the church leaders had been fasting that the Holy Spirit prompted them to send Paul and Barnabas out as missionaries. Should the Jews not have killed their enemies? Well, they're no real choice. The enemies were hateful, armed, and aggressive. It was a kill or be killed situation. The main population was just standing on the sidelines waiting to see how this is going to work out, who would win out. So the theme is the marvelous providence of God in protecting his children of Israel. And this is the key verse. Who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? God's providence works out in our lives, folks. It works out in your life and in mine. As Mordecai told her, if you keep silent this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, that you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?
Let's pray.
Father, thank you for giving us this time together and for giving us the lessons of the book of Esther. Please bless our morning service now, for we ask in Jesus' name.